It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When someone puts together an art exhibit, they are hoping that people will come to see it. There are four new exhibits at the Falconer Gallery at Grinnell College that are depending on visitors for more than just appreciation. Culture and Community, Projects About Place, opened about 2 weeks ago, and it's designed to pull the community into the museum in some non-traditional ways. And Leslie Wright, who is the director of the gallery and also curator of the exhibition, is here with us today. Hello, Leslie.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here. Can you tell me a little bit about the concept behind these exhibits?
The concept behind these exhibits is to bring the focus of the art world onto Grinnell and see what an artist might be able to do with a community and develop a project about that community. The show developed after I did a large exhibition about art in the Midwest 7 years ago, and we've been looking for a new idea ever since. And I wanted to work in a project basis with different artists. I didn't want to do one big group show, but I wanted to have individual projects. And by turning the focus on the community, we were able to get at interesting aspects of Grinnell that people generally overlook.
So when you had this idea and you started brainstorming about all of the different ways that you could feature the community or get community participation, how did you narrow it down to the projects that you chose?
I think I narrowed it down to the artists I wanted to work with more than necessarily the ideas. I let them generate those ideas. So the first one that was sort of on the docket, it was actually the Stephen Longmire photography show, but I didn't know quite where to place that project until the whole concept started to come together.
Okay, and we'll talk more about his photography in a little while. I think probably the part of the exhibition that may be easiest for people to wrap their minds around is the Grinnell People's Museum. Can you tell me a little bit about that concept?
Sure. This is working with a pair of artists, Marguerite Paré and Bruce Schurting, who for a long time were Iowa artists but now live and work in Lawrence, Kansas. They are always very interested in a kind of a scientific approach to doing their art. And in this case, they got very interested in the whole notion of collecting, what people collect, why they collect it, how collecting helps us memorialize a place or an idea. And the whole concept started when they toured Grinnell College and looked at all the things that we collect at the college. But then they wanted to widen it out to the broader community and develop the idea of the People's Museum, where people would bring their own personal objects to us. We would make a high-resolution scan on a flatbed scanner. And then the artist manipulated those images into a visual museum about the community. And everything from microphones to children's toys, perfume bottles to jewelry have been put together, and the objects in themselves are not particularly remarkable, but as a whole display, it's an amazing picture of our community. And then the stories we ask people to write are really quite moving about why these things matter to them.
How did you reach out to the community to find those objects?
We took our scanner to all sorts of interesting places, and when we would advertise that we were going to be there looking for people's objects. So we scanned at the library, we scanned at City Hall, we scanned at the local coffee shop, we scanned at the alternative high school, and we have a home show in Grinnell where people come to look at, you know, the latest in home design stuff. And I had a booth there all the way through the home show one day, and we collected a lot of objects there.
And the requirement was you were not looking for photographs. I think when a lot of people think about their family memories or their community memories, they think about photographs, but you didn't want that. You wanted actual objects.
You wanted three-dimensional objects. And so sometimes people would kind of have to rack their brains as they were standing there saying, well, I'd want to do this, but what do I have? And we'd say, well, what's in your backpack? What do you always carry with you? And that generated a lot of conversation and ideas. At a certain point, we had to say, no more dark glasses, no more hats, no more keychains, because they were becoming very popular. And then people had to get a little more creative.
What are some of your favorite objects in that exhibit? When looking through your brochure, the rain gauge really stood out for me. Was that from a local hardware store?
It was from a hardware store in Hartwick, which is a little tiny town in our county. And it was something this woman has had since, I think, the 40s or the 50s.
In 1947, it was a giveaway item. I thought that was a wonderful thing.
We had one woman bring in these tiny little perfume needles that is the way they used to give away sample perfume. And she'd saved these five little beautiful golden needles all these years. They were really a remarkable treasure. We had a woman come in with her grandfather's gunsmithing tools, which are like look like miniature tools, but they were used to make all the little handmade parts on guns. He used to handmade guns, and the tools themselves were remarkably beautiful.
So when people come in to view the facsimiles of these objects, what do you want them to gain from that experience?
Well, this piece has been installed in a small way in the Faulkner Gallery, but the largest parts of the installation are at the public library in a big window that's probably 16 feet wide by 8 feet high, and in four skylight windows in our student center. So people come across them in the midst of doing other things. And we want them to see that these objects are something that we take for granted in our daily life, but by casting a focus on them, suddenly they become remarkable. They go from being ordinary to being marvelous.
Well, you have brought along with you today some of the artists who are involved in the other parts of this whole exhibition. And Jane Gilmore is an artist who lives in Cedar Rapids. And your part in this exhibition is called Unseen Work, Traditions and Transitions. Can you tell me a little bit about the concept behind what you did?
Yes, this is really I found an opportunity to look at the kinds of jobs and the people that keep a small town or any town really going. They generally go unrecognized, people who clean, factory workers, healthcare workers, all the people who deliver the newspaper. These are all people that we do see them, but we think about them, but largely their contributions go ignored. And so the purpose was to try to give them a voice.
Okay. And how did you select the people to talk to?
Well, we had a community liaison. It was Robin Young that Leslie organized, trying to find someone who had some connections in the community and also was very outgoing, because my experience with this kind of thing is it's hard to get people to be interviewed, especially video interviewed, and especially people who work in jobs that they don't necessarily think are something people will recognize. So she worked with getting different groups together, and I went with them to community meals, and we sort of talked up the project. This started right after the first of the year. And two Grinnell students that did have experience in interviewing did the actual interviewing with Robin present, so they had videotaped to interview. So we started getting people, and then we got more and more. And, you know, after about 30, I thought we probably had enough, but we kept getting more. And so it ended up being about 50 or 60 people. So it became more and more popular, and people, after they had been interviewed, were thanking us. I mean, really, it had just been their voice, but I think the chance to speak is what energized them.
Well, we have an excerpt from one of those interviews that we're going to play right now.
I got a job up here at Grinnell College. Like I said, I worked there almost close to a year. I realized that wasn't my thing. I wasn't a janitor, just wasn't going anywhere, you know. And back then, they didn't pay any money. I think I cleared like $242 a month. It was terrible, you know. So then I got a job at Maytag, which Maytag was paying like $3 an hour, I think, back then. And that was a lot of money. I always figured if I could clear $100 a week, I was a tall cotton, you know. That was good money to spend. So I worked there, and then, of course, they had a layoff. Maytag used to have layoffs, and there wasn't nowhere to go to work. And then Uncle Sam put me to work, and I became a medic in the military. I worked in several emergency rooms and operating rooms. Plus, I was a combat field medic, worked on people. And after I'd done all that, I decided after almost 14 years and I got hurt, they decided it was time for me to leave, they gave me a choice. I'd either put in for retirement or they would, so I retired from that.
And that's an excerpt from one of the interviews that was conducted for this project that Jane Gilmore has done. It's called Unseen Work, Traditions and Transitions. And on the DVD that we got that showed all of these different interviews, there wasn't name identification. These were fairly anonymous interviews. Is that how they're displayed?
Each person had the choice of signing their name or not signing their name. And actually, most of them in the end, at first they were hesitant, but in the end, on the written portion, most of them did sign their name. And there is a list of names of all the people that wanted to contribute and wanted people to know that they contributed with the DVD on the thank you list. So
you collected all of these stories. How are they displayed?
Well, several ways, but one is in the video, and Matt Butler, who is an artist in Iowa City, was the one who actually coordinated the video and made it work, taking excerpts. And there is a full library of all the interviews that will go to the Iowa Labor Archives later. But the actual installation is a large walk-in book. Maybe you would say it's like a large scrapbook. It's about 8 feet high by 12 feet wide, and it has about 8 pages of writings from everybody involved. And these writings are divided into 12 by 12 squares, so it's like a grid. And the choices primarily were made by myself and one or two of the students I was collaborating with. We tried to use the handwriting, different kinds of handwriting, so it felt like different people. In addition, in the scrapbook, there are images of some of the places where people worked and the workers themselves.
Well, we'll talk more about some of those stories that are on display in your part of the exhibit, and we'll talk about all of the other parts of the exhibit as well. Jane Gilmore is an artist who lives in Cedar Rapids. Her part of the exhibit is Unseen Work, Traditions and Transitions. I've also been talking with Leslie Wright, who is the director of the Faulkner Gallery and the curator of the exhibition, which is called Culturing Community, Projects About Place. And we'll talk more about the exhibition in a moment. You're also welcome to join our conversation with your comments or your questions, 866-780-9100. If you're listening and you've been a part of this process, let us know what it meant to you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about the art exhibition Culturing Community, Projects About Place, that opened a couple of weeks ago at the Faulkner Gallery at Grinnell College. And we've been talking about some of the different parts of that project. Later on this hour, in about 15 minutes, I'll be talking with Harley McElrath, who is the author of the new short story collection, Possum Trot. And with me right now is Leslie Wright. She's the director of the Faulkner Gallery and curator of the exhibition. Also, Jane Gilmore is an artist who lives in Cedar Rapids. And right before the break, we were talking about your part of the exhibition, which is called Unseen Work, Traditions and Transitions. And you conducted interviews with many people who do jobs that I guess normally don't get a lot of attention, like convenience store clerks and janitors and people who do the work that keeps communities going. With the stories that you collected, are there any that particularly moved you?
Well, there was such a wide range historically. Like, I was really interested in some of the early ones, like people who had grown up during the Depression. Also, the number of people who were farmers, especially from that time on, all along while maintaining second jobs. So they almost always came home from work and went right back out to work. But I think I was overall impressed by just how seriously people took their jobs, at the same time what great sense of humor they had about it. At first, I was very skeptical, but I started listening to the interviews. I was like, these people are being way too nice. They're not talking about that somebody's got to hate their job. Someone's got to have issues. And
it sure seems like it.
It does, yeah. And no one was complaining much, you know, and I thought something must be wrong. But by the end of the project, I realized for the most part, these people are very happy and nice. I mean, they certainly do have complaints about jobs, but they have ways of dealing with it, which I found very healthy. And I think many of their stories are so unique. It's just, you know, there are as many unique stories as there are people. One of them worked as a bill collector, and he said he will never again say have a nice day, because they were instructed after telling someone that they were going to sue them if they didn't pay their bill. And at the end of the conversation, they always had to say have a nice day. And he said, I can't repeat those words. Another one collected all the notes that were ever sent back to her on bills in the past due department at the telephone company. And some of them were so great. They were thanking them, and others were like, you know, which we don't want to pay our bill through automatic checking. And you know, so they were – it's like she also gave a voice to all the people she sent her bills to. So in general, I think there were probably too many great stories to focus on.
And what do you want people to take away from the experience of reading these stories and going into that giant scrapbook that you've created?
Well, I think there are several things. Leslie talks about an in-between space, that a community is something that is constantly in flux and has various definitions. But I think in this case, the museum, the gallery, becomes the in-between space. And so this brought people to the gallery that probably wouldn't normally come to the gallery. And it also brought people from the museum out into the community. Some of these people did know each other before, some didn't. But when they all came together, at least the night of the opening, it was really an interesting phenomena and really the development of another kind of a community. So I think for one thing, it's empowering to see your voice on these metal notes and to hear yourself talking about your job. They also made individual books about their experience of work and their family history of work. And so far, all we've gotten is people calling, just saying thank you. I think it's made them feel like they do contribute something to the community. And it's made the people who don't think about them much understand that contribution.
Well, and Leslie, it sounds like part of the goal of this part of the exhibition might be to create an ongoing relationship that hadn't been there before between people who had never thought of going to an art gallery.
Absolutely. It's always one of the challenges when you do something in the arts to try to reach a new audience. And we were very cognizant of the fact that after 11 years, the Faulkner Gallery has a lot of regulars and people that will always come to our show. But what about other people that might really enjoy what we do but didn't feel like it was their place to step into the gallery? And we wanted to honor them in a way that would then give them the confidence to come in, see this exhibition, and we hope come back in the future.
Another part of the exhibition is called Ideal X, and Lee Emma Running is here. She is an artist who lives in Grinnell, and you are a member of – this is an international group of artists that's involved in Ideal X. Can you tell me a little bit about the project?
Absolutely. Ideal X is a project developed by The Moving Crew, which is an international artist collective. And we are a collective that's ever-growing. We're amorphous. And one of the things that we say about ourselves is that you might already be a member. So we're really interested in creating site-responsive projects. Our group gets together. And in the past, we've done a lot of projects about a specific place. But as our collective has grown over the last 5 years, we've encountered a problem that I think a lot of contemporary art collectives face, which is how do you keep collaborating over a great distance? How do you keep people involved? And one of our members who lives in Rijeka, Croatia, had a proposition of a gallery space there that we might be able to do some work in, and it's inside an international port. And in discussing, thinking about how this would work, we realized that there were shipping containers coming into both her port, but also coming in all over the country. And Grinnell is at the crossroads of an east-west and a north-south train line, as well as being right along I-80. So we had really all of these methods of transportation of the shipping container located for the exhibition. And we were able to develop this two-part project using the shipping container itself as a site for international collaboration.
And the shipping containers that inspired this are the kind that can be carried on a train, that can be stacked up on a barge to cross the oceans, that can be hooked up to a semi-truck. So these are the containers that move objects and goods all over the world all the time. They've really become the standard. How do you incorporate these shipping containers into an art exhibition?
Well, the first ship to actually move they're called intermodal containers, and the first ship to actually move these was called Ideal X in 1956, and it really transformed the world of public commerce that transformed the way we import and export. And it seemed an ideal sort of – partially the name seemed – ideal. How could we invent something that was better than that? And our group decided to sort of deconstruct this object, deconstruct this space. And we custom produced 1,728 small cardboard boxes that are the exact proportions of a shipping container. Instead of 8 feet by 20 feet, these are 8 inches by 20 inches. And we worked with artists all over the world to send us images for what the ideal shipping company would look like. We asked for mottos. We asked for graffiti to be on the sides of these boxes. And we worked with screen printing workshops both in Rijeka and in Grinnell to get these boxes printed so that we could physically handle the space of the container. And the other question that we've been asking throughout the show is really what's inside this container? What's inside an ideal shipping container? And is what comes into our communities through these shipping containers what we really need and what we really want? Or would we ideally want something else?
What is in the shipping containers that you've created?
There's ideas inside them. I mean, they are a space to be filled with the content of the community that they're inside of. We've gotten responses from all over, written responses. We've had students create videos of what is inside shipping containers, again, in both places, in Grinnell and in Rijeka. And all of that has been – we've had photos, and all of that has been uploaded to our website, which is sort of a living archive of the body of the project.
And how do you get people – and how have you gotten people in Grinnell involved? How have you brought the community into this exhibit?
In a lot of different ways. I mean, students have been involved. We had a wonderful group of students make a set of videos a couple of weeks ago, and that was phenomenal. They made videos in a 1 week marathon. But some things are just as simple as we were screen printing in the rotunda outside of Buxbaum, outside of the Falconer Gallery, and just the act of printing and working with these massive boxes and this volume of cardboard. People who were passing by just got involved. A student one evening said, "I was just walking down this hall and now suddenly I'm part of an artist collective."
So when people visit the gallery, if they haven't been involved in some way already, when they visit the gallery, what will they see of the IDLX project?
They will see our container. They'll see our cardboard boxes that make the container.
All right, and so you have all of these cardboard boxes put together so that they create something that is the exact same size as one of these actual shipping containers.
Absolutely. Yep. So the volume is there. It's sort of made manifest. There's also a large wall in which students or anyone can write down what they would want inside a container. So that space is there for them to physically write. Our website is there. And then we've also made a shipping container sort of viewing station. We have a film running in there of some of the archive of the project that people can see.
What happens to all of these individual small shipping containers when this exhibition closes?
We have two sets of them. One is in Rijeka, has been acquired by the Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art there, and it's hopefully traveling to an exhibition in Sarajevo in February. The exhibition here is going to be used in the spring for a main stage production with the dance ensemble at Grinnell College, and we'll see what happens to its life beyond that.
And what is your hope that people will take away from interacting with these shipping containers?
We really hope that people will notice this unseen space in some ways. These containers surround us. And one of the things that happened in this project was that we asked people to become container spotters, to locate containers in their communities, whether they're in fields or moving on highways. And I've been amazed by the stories that I've heard from people about shipping, and really just to make visible something that is such an invisible but incredibly important part of our daily lives, no matter where we live.
IDLX is part of this exhibition at Falconer Gallery at Grinnell College, and the exhibition is called Culture and Community, Projects About Place. Leslie Wright, the director of the gallery, is here with us still. And Leslie, in addition to opening these four different exhibits. The other one that we haven't talked about is a photography collection based on a cemetery in Rochester, Iowa. It's called Life and Death on the Prairie, and it's a very old cemetery, and it's also a vestige of the prairie as well. You opened, you had people come in and look, but there's an ongoing conversation with the community that continues. Can you tell me more about that?
It's very important with every exhibition that we do that we energize the exhibition with a great deal of programming. We find that if you open the doors to people to come in at where their interests are, they will then open their eyes to things that they may not have paid attention to before. So we've already had readings, we've had concerts, we've had a panel discussion. This week we have another panel discussion. We're trying to bring people into the gallery as much as possible. But by placing parts of the exhibition outside the gallery, we're also having people find us through other mechanisms, wander in because they saw the library, wander in because they were up in the student center. And a lot of the people who've been involved so far in Lee's project, in Jane's project, in the collective, have come back multiple times because they want to see it, and they realize that when you come back multiple times, you see more than you saw the first time.
You've also had and will have some panel discussions. What kinds of topics will you be exploring?
The first panel was about wellness in the community. Grinnell has been on a sort of building boom with facilities for wellness, and we wanted to bring all those people together. And it was remarkable in hearing them all talk about how much they are working together, whether it's the recreation department in the town, or the new pool that the college has just built, or the new pool that the city has just built. They are all talking to one another. They're talking to the hospital about how they can each help one another promote wellness across the community. We have one this week, which we're talking to a group of faculty members who use the community actively in their teaching and in their scholarship, about how each discipline looks at community. So it's those sort of topics that we're trying to bring together.
As people have been coming into the gallery, what kind of responses have you had?
People who are unfamiliar with installation-based art will immediately go to the photography first, and they get interested. And then they start looking around and paying more attention. And I think what really inspires them is that, especially with Jane and Lee's pieces, they can interact with it. They can write on the wall. They can go open up the books themselves, and they can have their own opportunity to touch and feel the exhibition. And then they open up and look more, and they look more and more closely and come back around and talk and ask questions and give us their impressions and their personal reflections.
And have you had anyone who normally wouldn't have come into the gallery talk to you about what they felt?
Absolutely. At the opening, we had a number of people who had participated in some stage of the project, and most of them stayed for the entire opening. They were so happy to be there. They've come back. They send their friends. They are becoming some of our best ambassadors for what we do at the Faulkner Gallery, and so that's very inspiring.
Have Lee and Jane, what kind of reactions have you guys been hearing about to your work? Lee, you can go first.
I mean, the responses have been wonderful, but it's really been exciting for us to realize, partially because the boxes have come out into the community through dance, through public interaction, and we've run workshops in Chicago, in Iowa City, in Rijeka. The responses that have come back have really been, we didn't know art could look like this. Like, we didn't know that it could feel like this. And it's so exciting to be part of something that is international and that does have space for so many voices. And I think that's one of the goals of our collective, is really to activate public space and sort of enliven the public sphere.
How about you, Jane? What kind of reaction have you gotten?
I think primarily, because I'm not in Grinnell, I've gotten email after email from the participants just saying, oh, thank you. You know, this has sort of changed my life in the way I think about how I work. But also from people who've seen the exhibit, I think their ideas about everyday work that keeps a community going have changed. And I think also the issue that Lee brings up is that the form that art takes, sometimes a non-traditional form, is perhaps a better way to give people a voice than a traditional one, but it takes some getting used to.
And Leslie, these objects and photographs and all of this display continues through December 12th. What do you hope happens after that? What do you hope the lasting effect of this exhibition will be?
I hope we will continue to do projects with artists that are developed with people around us. I think it gives people a way of thinking about art that is empowering. I think it's a way of thinking about contemporary art in particular that makes it a reality in their daily life that otherwise I think it's something that's away from them and that they won't touch.
All right. Thank you so much for your time today. My guests were Leslie Wright, the director of the Faulkner Gallery, also Jane Gilmore, a Cedar Rapids-based artist, and Lee Emma Running, a member of the Moving Crew. The exhibition is called Culture and Community, Projects About Place. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Possum Trot, the new collection of short stories, evokes a rural Iowa that's full of family farms and dirt roads and pickup baseball games among young boys, but it doesn't necessarily paint that past in a purely sentimental light. J. Harley McElrath is the author of Possum Trot. He's also the assistant manager and book buyer for the Grinnell College Bookstore and the Pioneer Bookshop in Grinnell. And Harley, you grew up on a family farm, right?
I did. I grew up on the family farm near Newburgh, which is also near Grinnell.
All right. It's kind of in the middle of of a very rural area.
Right.
So is this a past that represents your family that you paint a picture of in the book?
A lot of the stories come from experiences from my family that I've had on the farm or can be influenced by stories that my family would tell. I had an extended family that was very large, and we had traditional family dinners. Everybody got together on Sunday, and we would gather around the table at Thanksgiving or Christmas or whenever, and one of the things that my family did for sport was talk. And my grandfather liked to tell funny stories, and my dad likes to tell stories, and my uncle. And so a lot of the feel and flavor of the book comes from those stories.
And as I mentioned, it's not necessarily a sentimental look at life on the family farm in rural
right.
Iowa. Was there something that you wanted to – because I think we do sentimentalize that past. Was
right.
there something that you wanted to convey?
I wanted the stories to be good as stories outside of the setting. They're not really about Iowa, but they're from Iowa, and they're Iowan, I think, all the way through. But what was really interesting to me was the characters and their situations and how they dealt with the situations and how they dealt with life's problems. But in situating the stories, I wanted them to be here. I grew up reading lots of fiction novels, short stories, watching lots of movies, and there was nothing from here for the most part. You have to go back to Hamlin Garland or Ruth Succo to get Iowa fiction that's good. And so it was important to me that these events happen in a space that we all live in here.
And why did you – most of the stories, not all of the stories take place in the past. There are a couple of the stories that are contemporary.
Right.
But why was that past so interesting to you in writing these stories?
Well, as I grew up, the past was part of the present because of the stories. When my family sat at the table and talked, the conversation ranged over a period of time that could have stretched from the turn of this past century to the present, and there was no real sense that there was a difference in the validity or the immediacy of those stories. When they talked about another family or another person, they were connected to a chain that went as far back as you could see up to the present point. And some of the stories are set in the past because I liked the feel. There's a darker feeling to it and a more elemental aspect to the past, I think, when it's less mechanical, less technological. And, a story changes. Something that was a significant event in the past that was, tragedy could happen because a person had to get from point A to point B and there was some barrier between them. Well, now you pick out your cell phone out of your pocket and you call and they come get you.
Right.
You know, and 30, 40 years ago, you didn't have that option. You had to deal with the situation as in yourself as it presented to yourself. And so that changes how you can approach the story then.
Well, I'd love for you to give us all a taste of what these stories are like, and they are all very different. But one of the stories in the collection is called Rain, and it's a very short story, and I'd love for you to read us the whole thing.
I will be happy to. Sure. Rain is a story that I wrote. It's one of my favorites. And it's my mother reads my stories, and she says, well, that was very good, but when will you write something that I'll like? And so this is one I could show to my mother and say, well, you'll like this one. It's called Rain. The rain came in a downpour. The boy's father stood watching in the open garage door, his hands sunk deep in denim pockets, the collar turned up on his jacket, and his cap pushed back on his head. The rain fell in gray sheets in front of him, splashing the grease-darkened leather of his Wolverine boots and running in streams down the driveway. Long as the oats don't go down, the boy's father said into the rain. They had seen it coming, great dark clouds gathering in the southwest, quiet flashes above the tree-marked horizon. Better shut the crib doors, his father had said, and the boy had run for the corn crib. At the house, the kitchen window slammed shut at the hint of thunder. Trying to beat the rain had been fun, pushing the crib doors shut and latching them, running to shut the chickens in while his dad backed the hay rack into the machine shed, then sprinting for the garage as the wind whipped across Plum's cornfield toward them. He had imagined that to be caught in the rain meant death, riddled in a storm of bullets like Bonnie and Clyde, each raindrop a bullet tearing through his flesh. Now he stood beside his father, trying to pick one raindrop out of the storm and follow it to the ground. "Twins are on today," the boy said. "Blylevin's pitching." The rain fell hard. In a lighter rain, he could pick out the different sounds the rain made when it hit the garage roof and the driveway and the sidewalk and the corn leaves and the tin roof on the grain bin. But in this downpour, all the sounds were forced into one great dull roar. "I think it's Louis Tiant for the Red Sox," the boy said. He picked up a piece of gravel, and like Louis Tiant, he tucked the rock tight against his chest, pivoted on his right foot until his back was to the door, and then whirled and tossed the rock out into the rain. "Do we have to stay out here, or can we go in and watch it?" A sparrow swooped down through the door and perched on a beam near the ceiling, shook the wet from its feathers. The sparrow shuddered, cocked its head nervously, and leapt from the beam back into the rain. The boy's father reached back with his boot and pushed a 5-gallon bucket toward the door. He flipped the bucket over and sat on it in the doorway, his elbows on his thighs and his hands clasped between his knees. The boy went to the workbench, where an old radio sat on a ledge by a window. He cleared a space on the bench and hopped up onto it. He looked out through the streaked window and watched the water overflow the eave spouts on the corn crib. Flies swarmed in the window, caught themselves in cobwebs, and vibrated their bodies against the glass. Thunder shook the window, and the boy turned and looked toward his father sitting on the bucket in the doorway. "Want to see if we can get it on the radio?" he asked. The boy hopped down off the workbench, walked over to the garage door, and stood beside his father. His father's face was dark from sun and wind and dirt, except at the hairline where his cap was pushed back and the skin showed white beneath it. The boy watched his father watch the rain. There was seriousness in his father's face, concentration, as if he was trying to understand something important, as if there was meaning in the rain that the boy did not see. The boy reached out and pulled apart his father's clasped hands, stepped between his father's legs. He leaned back against his father's chest. The hands closed around him, and he nestled himself in his father's arms. "I suppose it's raining in Minnesota, too," the boy said. He imagined the groundskeepers hurrying to roll the big tarp out over the infield, the fans running for cover in the stadium. He imagined the players slapping balls into their gloves, watching from the dugouts as the rain gathered in puddles on the tarp. He felt the scratch of stubble and the warmth of his father's breath on his face. "Will the oats go down?" the boy asked. "We'll see when she lets up," his father said. The boy listened to the steady roar of the rain beating on the garage roof, the gentle rumble of thunder. He watched the water stream in rivers down the sloughs of their neighbors' fields and rise in flat pools across the low ground. He felt his body carried on the ebb and flow of his father's breathing. When the rain let up, they would walk in the mud out the lane and across the pasture to see how the oats had fared. The rain would be falling still, lightly, and their clothes would be wet, and when the boy grew tired from the weight of the mud that pulled at his feet and gathered on his shoes, his father would lift him and carry him in his arms, glad for the company.
That's the story. That's the story, Rain, from the short story collection Possum Trot by J. Harley McElrath. And Harley is with me today. This past that you write about in so many of your stories, you know, if you drive around rural Iowa, you see a lot of family farms that have been abandoned, that have disappeared, and there are the large farms run by conglomerations in many parts, although some family farms still continue. But a lot of the people who are drawn to your stories, this is a past that they'll remember.
Right.
But is this an effort that you've made to preserve that past that you feel is slipping away?
I think selfishly for myself, it's an excuse to meditate on those times and those places and those people, because I miss them, and the extended family isn't there as much as it was, so we don't have that conversation anymore that keeps all that alive. And it's something I like to present for people who haven't had a literature that's set where they live. And I can think, you know, I read at the Grinnell Historical Museum one time, and it made me very happy because there was an older man who was sitting on the edge of his seat while I read the story. And in the story, there was a heifer having problems in calf birth, and they were pulling the calf. And this guy was on the edge of his seat, and he was listening. And I kept thinking, he's really into this story. And then it occurred to me, he cares about the calf.
Right.
He wants to know whether the calf's going to make it or not. And I thought that was all right. I thought I was glad that he could have that story that he could identify with.
Since this is something that really is in the past, I mean, as I mentioned, there are family farms, but they are fewer and fewer. And last week on Talk of Iowa, we were talking about agritourism and how people are actually paying money to go out and have an experience of being on the family farm. What do you think is important about that culture to communicate to people now who may not have had that experience?
Well, there was a closeness. There was a self-sufficiency in it. It was the family had to work together as a cohesive group. Everybody had a job, and there wasn't time. You know, we didn't just run to town because we'd forgotten something. If my mom wanted groceries, you know, if we were out of something, we had to coordinate that with a trip that was being made for an important thing, like a part for a piece of equipment. You know, that you could run to town for, but food was not essential. So I think there was just a closeness with the land. You know, in horse-drawn days, a farmer walked every foot of his land every year. And then we started with tractors, and he drove it, but he drove it slowly, and he was exposed to the elements. And now my cousin harvested the corn on our farm, 160 acres, just yesterday, and he was in and done in a day. And that would have been a year-long, you know, the interaction with that land would have been a year-long process on the family farm.
If this is a past you're familiar with and you'd like to talk about why you think it's important for all of us to have an experience with that past, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guest is Harley McElrath, and we're talking about his collection of short stories, Possum Trot. Something that also comes up a lot in many different stories. You mentioned the story where the heifer is having a hard time birthing her calf. And that story is about a boy and his father. And this story, Rain, that you just read, is about a boy and his father. It's that father-son relationship and grandfather-son relationship right. that you explored quite a bit. Why is that something you keep coming back to?
Well, I think partly because it's my experience. But also in that culture, The love between fathers and sons is unquestioned. It's very strong, and it's there, but it's not spoken of. You know, I don't think those fathers say, "Oh, I love you all the time." You know, but it's just known and it's assumed, and it's makes for interesting interaction in terms of the stories, because you have to show it. It can't, you know, the guy isn't just going to say it, and the son isn't going to say it. You know, that kid in Rain wasn't going to go to the house unless his dad said he could. And
right.
he didn't really want him to. You know, he wanted his dad to come with him. He wanted to watch the game together. And the dad didn't tell him that he could go because the dad wanted him there. And in the end, you find out that, you know, there's a love there, that the father's willing to carry the kid just to keep him there. So it's not just an authoritarian thing. There's reasons behind that.
And not just a you can be of use on the farm, because
right.
obviously carrying a child is going to slow you down with the farm work.
Right, exactly.
A little bit. Yep. You also mentioned the twins quite a bit. The twins baseball comes up in a couple of your stories, and I thought, well, where I grew up, all the farm kids were Cubs fans. So
yeah. Well, that's another. I guess the twins are back outside, but a while ago I would read this story, and it was odd because it was raining at a twins game when they were playing in the Dome by that point, you know. But yeah, I grew up with the Twins on WHO. I can remember in music class in second grade, I think Miss Tisdale went around. We all had to say what radio station we listened to and what kind of music. And Brett Benson and I both said WHO and the Minnesota Twins.
Beautiful music for a summer.
That's right.
Randy's on the line in Iowa County. Hello, Randy.
Good morning.
Hi.
Back when I was a rug rat, we had milking shorthorn cows. And I had a guy come off the town one time and says, all milk tastes the same. Now, one cow's cream in the milk might be thicker or more pronounced. But I said, yeah, if you're drinking from a Holstein cow, it's just plain old Holstein milk. So we used to have calves that would come out to the barn and you'd squirt them with milk. And I had one specific cat when I was still milking cows in the early 70s that would stand on her back legs, and I'd get a cow that had a big teeth full of milk and squirt the milk in her face about maybe a foot and a half or so from the back end of the cow. And I got this picture of this cat with the milk running down the sides of her mouth with her tongue going out, going, so, you know, you can visualize that without much more, whatever you want to call it. It's just, there's a lot of things that are gone, but, you know, we still have the memories. And I have a picture of a Spitz dog that was the hog dog, and a picture of him from above with that stream of milk heading toward his mouth. And you could see the kickers, the ring on the kickers on the cow leg. So I was trying to milk with one hand and squirt milk in the dog's mouth with the other hand.
Well, Randy, thank you so much for sharing your stories. And, I mean, Harley, when you hear stories like that, it does sound like your stories can bring back those memories for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think so. And that's part of what I hope will happen. Another time I was reading and there was an old woman who it was answer question time, you know, and she raised her hand and she didn't have a question. She wanted to know if I wanted to hear a story about my great-grandmother's house, you know, and she stood up and she told me a story that was just as good or better than the story I had read to her. So that's the trade-off.
You have spent many, many years in the book selling business, and now you have a book of your own. How does that feel to have switched roles?
It's a little odd. And I learned things, you know, about publishers and whatnot that, you know, you might have always suspected was true, but didn't know. So it's I've always been comfortable to sit in the shadows and stand to the side while someone else read, and then I would step up to sell the book. So it takes some adjustment to have to stand in the spotlight myself.
Now, of course, probably everybody who writes a book is hoping that it will be widely sold and widely read. And you as a bookseller know that that doesn't usually happen to people. But what is your hope as this book goes out into the world? What's your fondest hope?
Well, my fondest hope is that people will read it and that it'll wind up on the shelf with Ruth Succo and Hamlin Garland and Doug Bauer and some of those people that have also written Iowa literature, and people will go back and enjoy it for years.
All right, Harley, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Harley McElrath is the author of a new collection of short stories on sale now. It's called Possum Trot. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Mitchell Schmidt. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we'll also take a look at the past with David Plowden on his new book, Requiem for Steam.